It is an honor for me to have in my house the visit of Guerino Mazzola, which is a musician, a scientist, a mathematician I admire most. And I would love to have a conversation with him recorded, because he has so many interesting things to say. And I would like to ask you first, just as a start of the conversation, why jazz? Why free jazz with Guerino Mazzola?
Oh, this is a good question. I started playing piano when I was 6 years old, and then when I was 11, my uncle, and I was, of course, learning just, you know, all the classical things, Czerny and also other things, but no jazz. And my uncle, one day he brought a recording by Errol Garner. It was called Concert by the Sea. And I was completely fascinated by this jazz recording. So I decided to change from classical music to jazz. I loved it very much. And then, of course, I developed, you know, from the early jazz, like Count Basie, and I went through Errol Garner and Bill Evans, and then McCoy Tyner, and then I think what was really what turned into free jazz, you know, McCoy Tyner for me was not really free jazz. It was very nice, structured, very good jazz, but also when he played with Coltrane, he was not playing free jazz. So that's also one reason why Coltrane then left McCoy Tyner and then just went on with his own wife. Alice Coltrane. So the real change was in 75 when Cecil Taylor, the free jazz, very famous free jazz pianist, came to Switzerland, and I saw him. That was a fabulous concert with Jimmy Lyons and Andrew Cyril. And I remember he already played when the curtain went opened, you know, was already playing, and no white light, only yellow light, and he had a gold shirt. Everything was really very hot, and he played very, very long, extremely intense. At the end, I think 40% of the people was there, and the other 60 were gone, and from the 40, most were sleeping, and the music was incredibly dense, and this changed my whole approach to music. So then I started to try to learn his technique, which is something it takes you 10 years. And so that was the external kind of motivation for changing from normal jazz to free jazz. Now, I think the jazz was always important to me, because when I was playing classical music, I was always thinking, oh, I could also play something else. And I thought, why this chord? I had some ideas of playing something which came to my mind. So the variation was always kind of disturbing when I played this chord, you know, kind of like, oh, I could be, why could I better make this and that? So I think it was just in my character that I wanted to make things by myself.
But beauty was present all the time, no? When how this sounds and this other, you were
absolutely
looking up so always for beauty.
Yes, I mean, it's not a question of beauty, but who makes the beauty.
Aha.
So I was interested in making the beauty, and not of just, you know, repeating a given beauty, but kind of creating, because I thought, oh, I've understood how that works. So I wanted to find out how that works when I make it myself, you know. I also opened, clocks and tried to decompose them and look how they are made. So I was always kind of trying to find out things. So beauty, I would not just buy it and accept it, but I wanted to find out how you make it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the point. And I think then this Cecil Taylor was just a level of existence which is higher than normal music for me. It was kind of going to a more intense, more deeper state of existence when you play very intensely, very kind of you're united with the piano, you are kind of playing into the piano. That was the time when I started taking away the cover of the keys, you know, because I wanted to play into the piano. But it has also a technical reason, because, you know, the movements by octaves, I like to have the fingers stretched. So when I make this movement, it's better. But it was also philosophical in the sense of playing into the piano another way, kind of, you know, the piano is something, stupid machine down there, but I wanted really to kind of be united with the piano.
Yes, the technique I heard you play, seen you play, and there's many recordings of you, and it's impressive. I mean, the technique you used to play is you think you created, probably.
Yes.
You created that technique, that way of playing.
That it's true, I heard Cecil Taylor, but I didn't see exactly how he was making it. So I tried to find out how you can play those fast, or whatever you call it, clusters. They call it clusters, they are not clusters. It's just very fast sequences of sounds. And I thought that can only, there cannot be an independent playing of two hands, because you cannot play very long, very regularly, such a fast sequence of sounds like brrr. So I invented a technique which I then, after when I saw Cecil Taylor from near how he played, it turned out that it was a real invention. He didn't play like that. So he plays the hands independently, and he plays the right hand down and the left hand up, but independently. They move independently, like, you know, like this. And I invented the technique of playing the left hand down and the right hand up, and but they hit each other like they are two springs. So the lower left hand hits the right, and then it hits it up, and then the right hits down the left one. So they are kind of a spring system, like a mechanical spring system, which then can resonate. So then you can play very precise, brrr, you know, you control exactly how you can make it. But the kind of these, the dynamics is kind of a spring system.
That doesn't exist in usually what is called classical music.
No.
I have never seen that. I was surprised to see that.
Yes.
That amazing technique you use.
Yes.
And the results, I mean, the sound you get in the piano is also impressive. I like it very much.
Thank you.
And also I can say when 10 years ago you came to Mexico and gave 3 concerts with Heinz and the drums.
Yes.
The Guarino Mazzola I saw in person, talking to him, and then the Guarino that appears in the scenery was a complete transformation.
Yes,
that was also impressive for me. The person transforms in the scenery as to an artist. You see, and that's the impression I got from you.
I have a funny anecdote to tell you. When I was 60, I was in Minnesota professor, and I invited my brother to come to my 60th birthday, and we went to a very good restaurant with my wife, my brother, and also my niece, and we had a fantastic dinner, and we drank quite a lot of wine, and I was quite drunken because I was so happy, you know, my brother and inviting him to Minnesota, and I was finally professor, and everything was fantastic. But I was kind of drunken, but in a nice way. And then we went home to my home, and I have a house there, and have my Steinway, and we arrived and were very happy and were just drinking a little bit more and so. And my brother said, "Hey, why don't you play some piano?" And I said, "Well, okay, that's a good thing. Like, let's play a little bit jazz." And I sat down and started playing, you know, nice blues, you know, kind of easy jazz. And then my brother said, "It's incredible how you transformed yourself when you sit at the piano. Before you were drunken, now you are completely clear in your mind. You are a completely different person."
That's the impression I got to see you. And also, it's people tell that about myself, about me.
Oh, really?
When they go into the scenery, Emilio Juiz is another kind of person. And I think that is how an artist projects things, no? It commits to his art, to what he's doing. And it's the artist projecting to the audience his own personality.
Yes. What I think is a little bit critical is that it looks like you are kind of switching on, switching off the artist. You know, you go on stage or mm-hmm. and you start, you're not transformed. And when you're finished, it's transformed back to the normal. And I think this is completely wrong. I think it's more inside, outside. Inside we are always artists and we just show it, you know.
That's right.
And I think you cannot be artist if you are just switch on, switch off.
No.
You know, but I think, you know, why should I show things which are not relevant and behave like an extraverted, stupid artist, you know, like mm-hmm. this strange hysterical behavior. So I think when we are artists, we just show another side. It's kind of we turn around, but it's not that something is kind of, we are not of other persons. It's another side of a big personality, and you see just one side. But the other side is like the moon, you know, the other side is always here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't see it a contradiction. I only see perhaps people don't like it that a personality can be more than just an artist, or more than just a scientist, or more than just one thing. They always believe that this is a contradiction. You cannot be mm-hmm. a pianist and a mathematician, or like me, a jazz man and a mathematician. They think this is a contradiction. And I very often had, when I was younger, I also didn't want to be invited to make both. Very often I was invited to say, okay, the first half an hour or so, 45 minutes, you tell something about mathematics, and then you play something piano. And I said, no, either you invite me as an artist or as a mathematician. I didn't like that, because I always thought they invite me for one thing because they want to only to listen to the other one, you know? So I thought, okay, you have to choose. Now it's different. Now I know that I have enough to say, but I would still not accept, that people see me as two different persons. And I think they should learn that this is one and the same thing, what we are doing. And I think we are kind of Renaissance persons, you know, who are at the same time artists and so-called scientists. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, we have to break this. We have really to show that this is...
I was going to say that it's the same thing. An artist in mathematics is a fine art, as to far as I'm concerned. I say that all the time. So when they ask me why the difference between the two, I say it's a fine art, both of them.
Yes.
So what essentially, we are artists both in both fields, no? But yes. I would like now to ask you something, and then why mathematics then? How mathematics appears in your life?
Well, I think I was always fascinated by trying to understand what I am doing, and in a more essential thing, as in an essential way, what I'm thinking. And I discovered quite early, I think when I was 14 or 15, that we really, really don't know what we are doing, and in a dramatic way. So I always try to find more precise concepts, more precise, you know, definitions and statements to find out where we are really as precise as we can, which is mathematics. Do we then understand everything, or are there still mysteries there? And I found out that on the very elementary level of mathematics, where we really start doing those difficult things, like, you know, defining operations of arithmetics and things, we have already mysteries. It's full of mysteries. I discovered that it's horrible that we think we understand everything and we understand nothing. I'll give you an example. There's this famous Goldbach conjecture, which tells that every even number can be written as a sum of two adequately chosen prime numbers, like 10 is 3 plus 7, it's also 5 plus 5, there is several ways, and this is such an easy question. It just uses multiplication and addition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so multiplication, addition, you know, these are so elementary things. The addition comes after the sequence of increasing numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4. Addition is then defined inductively, and then multiplication by use of addition is defined. So, and the prime number is just something which cannot be decomposed except if one of the factors is 1. So, this is so simple. And if I explain this to somebody, they would say after I would say half an hour of explanation, really extensive explanation, okay, now you are going to be boring now. And they say, you think I've understood everything? They say, of course. I mean, so what? This is, everything is clear. So I say, I ask you a question, and this is the Goldbach conjecture, and nobody can answer it, you know. Mm-hmm. It has not been answered. So this is just one small example. And, you know, there are other examples which are so easy. For example, when you go over from addition to multiplication by this inductive definition, the multiplication is defined by use of addition. And when you go over from multiplication to exponentiation, you start from multiplication, you go over to exponentiation using multiplication. So, but you know, multiplication is associative, yes? It's commutative, associative. But exponentiation is neither commutative nor associative. But if you look at the rules are exactly the same, yes? You have, if you compare the rules, it's exactly the same thing. I'm not going to explain it, but nobody knows why in one case you destroy the commutativity and in the other case you keep it. So there are so many questions of this level that are, and this is an abstract, precise, and the most precise, the most abstract science which comes to the essence of human thinking. That's why I love mathematics, because it's really the essential of human thinking. Precise and abstract, and I think the abstract is the concrete, that as I always say this, in the sense of it is the essence. Yes. So you see, there are so easy things. We think we understand. It's annoying. Every mathematician would say, come on, I mean, you know, the Peano axioms, that is really common, it's boring. And I say, okay, you think you have understood? Poof! I give now 3 questions, I have told them now, nobody knows why. So, you see, this is kind of going back to the insight that we really don't know what we are doing. I'm very honest to tell you, mm-hmm. in the most precise context which we have, we don't know what... To me, it's proof that we don't know what we do, because this easiest question we cannot answer, so for me it's a proof that something we don't understand. I don't know what you think, but...
Yes, I agree with you completely.
Yes,
yeah, of course.
It's a mystery, you know.
Yes.
Perhaps that answers a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now you didn't ask. Perhaps you also.
I will.
You will ask.
Yes,
you didn't
exactly.
ask the relation between music and mathematics, mm-hmm. but you will perhaps do that.
But I before I wanted to ask you to tell us when mathematical music theory appears in you, and why? I mean, you say some reasons, but.
Yes, I think this is a real very simple mm-hmm. anecdote, and it's true. I was doing music kind of as a kind of a counterpoint, existential counterpoint to mathematics. I was doing mathematics, you know, algebraic geometry and things like that, and I was doing music, free jazz, you know, as a kind of another world.
Mm-hmm.
With you know, at that time there was everybody was political, so everybody was left and kind of revolutionary, you know, in the 60s we had the famous hippies and all that revolution related to the Vietnam and all that, so everybody was that was normal. And I also heard free jazz because it was also Archie Shepp, you know, kind of this political protest, yes, mm-hmm. Because okay, free jazz is something much more than that, but at that time that was important. So I was also playing free jazz as a jazz which has this kind of emotional and political dimension, expressivity. And one day I was playing free jazz, I was playing, I was improvising, and all of a sudden, you know, I observed that, I asked my question, well, these notes which I'm playing, you know, they don't know about my political and my emotional status, they are just there, these are just structures, and they don't care. I mean, it's the same structures which I would play with completely different ideology. And I said to myself, well, what is this structure of the sounds which I'm producing independently of my ideological motivation? So I was shocked in some sense, saying, hey, I mean, there is a structure which is kind of independent of what I'm thinking as a philosopher or as a psychological being. Mm-hmm. And then I got really interested the first time in the question, what is the structure of the sounds independently of my psychological, social, political motivation. So then I started thinking about, well, you know, these are events which have an onset and a pitch and all these parameters, and I started thinking about music as a structure, as a structure which is not only kind of an expression of certain motivations, but a kind of an independent, neutral structure. And of course then I could apply algebraic geometry, I could apply, I mean, linear algebra, you know, spaces with coordinates, and I had studied theoretical physics, so I knew about how to represent objects in a multidimensional space. So then I started to look at that, and I discovered very quickly that music theory then also considers such spatial representation of sounds, and symmetries are of course also classically considered. But then I discovered that it was not so good. It was kind of very elementary, very simple, and of course I was full of mathematics, and then I started asking me the questions, typical questions in physics. What is the kind of representation of the data? So mm-hmm. you create kind of spaces where these data are represent, mathematical spaces, mm-hmm. you know, like vector spaces or whatever spaces you have, like in physics. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the logical thing was also there are certain events and the regularities and effects which you see in music, like harmonic things or rhythmical things or whatever, and they show certain rules. There are certain rules, like mm-hmm. counterpoint rules or harmonic modulation from one tonality to the other. All these things I observed, there are certain regular phenomena, and like in physics you see, you know, like gravitation, if you have your apple, it always falls down, so it likes this. And so I started reading a harmony book. First of all, of course, for me was a very good advice of a free jazz colleague which was studying at the conservatory. He said, I think the most interesting is Schoenberg's Harmony. It's one of a critical but intelligent book, and I started reading that, and I saw it was a whole system of modulation and kind of, you know, construction of chords and all these things. And then I started thinking about models, like physicists make models of reality, and then they look whether the models are true or not, so they verify the models and make experiments. So this kind of theory, first of all, representation in mathematical terms, and then you make a model, and then you look whether the model works. And that was a real hard work, and I don't know why, but it was Pollini's interpretation of the Hammerklavier Sonata which put me back to, I mean, first of all it was Opus 57, Sviatoslav Richter's interpretation of Appassionata, which I think was a fantastic thing.
Yes.
And then I discovered Pollini's Hammerklavier, which for me was really a revelation, and much more than later when I heard Barenboim playing it, or even Gould, which is horrible. But then Pollini kind of told me, wow, that is something really strong going on. Mm-hmm. And I tried to then develop a model of harmonic modulation. And I read certain books, important books, like Erwin Rath's book on harmony, and who deals with the Hammerklavier, that this is a very problematic structure, because certain transitions are not as they are told in this in the canonical theory, like, you know, the passage to the dominant for the side part of the exposition and things like that. So there are kind of very strange things happening there. So I, of course, I was kind of interested in developing a model which could apply to that. So I started doing those things, and I developed a model based on symmetries, and which showed kind of a very nice congruence with the experiment. Mm-hmm. Of the Hammerklavier. So the Hammerklavier was an experiment, right? Mm-hmm. An analytical experiment trying to understand the given fact by a certain model. And then I had an experience. There was a physics professor, Professor Scharf, a theoretical physicist. He read my analysis and he said, yes, I think that's quite good. He was a pianist also. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, Guarino, but I think you should try to construct a sonata using those structures, because, you know, just analyzing, you could analyze it in 10 different ways. You could use Schenker's theory and other theories, so it's not a proof that you're right. You're like in physics, you have to make an experiment. So he made me compose that sonata that was an experiment to see whether the model is also applicable to composition.
That's fantastic. And also what I'm so much impressed is how you have to have such a big mathematical culture as you have, yes, in order, and how to apply it to model these things. That's really ingenious. I'm quite surprised somebody like you,
yes,
do that. There are not many persons in the world that can do that.
What is your problem? I mean, since I have so much mathematics, it is easy to select a good one. You know.
Because you know what to choose from, no?
Yeah, but this is not so easy as you tell me. You know, I have been talking to Octavio, now the this very gifted doctoral student who is making counterpoint theory. Mm-hmm. And before he had his talk, he asked me, you know, how did you find out about this theory? And mm-hmm. I said, you know, well, I was studying consonances and dissonances, and while I was improvising, all of a sudden I said to myself, well, couldn't there be a symmetry between these two parts? And I mean, this took me a long time. I had been thinking about consonances, dissonances, you know, the Helmholtz theory, all the theories which you know, and I was not happy with that. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, isn't there a relation between these two things, you know, not just kind of different categories of hearing, but kind of a structural principle. So that took me quite long. And then, I mean, this is just the beginning to have a symmetry. And then, how can you find then any model which then allows you to deduce this, for example, the forbidden parallels? And it's like my modulation model, you know? It took me months. Yes. I was experimenting. Oh, could it be, for example, with the Beethoven, I always thought, oh, that must be some symmetry of the diminished seventh chord in general modulation theory. Well, it was that theory, that symmetry in the Hammerklavier, but the general modulation theory had nothing to do. So, you know, I was playing around with kind of different approaches. Who should I take? Only this symmetry? No, I take more symmetries. Then you calculate, and no, nothing comes out. And it was the same as a counterpoint. You experiment for months, mm-hmm. and you think, you know, it's like, for example, modulation theory. This is this theorem which tells, you know, which are the critical properties which you should ask for generating a so-called modulation quantum. So this is a kind of a chord or a set of notes which have certain properties. And of course, the experience in physics tells you much about, mm-hmm. you know, like, for example, this economical principle of the least energy, so kind of optimization problems or kind of approaches to say, you know, I want to take all the symmetries which have this property, but then I take the smallest one because I don't want to have more nodes than necessary to express this symmetry. So you kind of, you play around.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and you always try to, you know, to express what you feel by precise concepts. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, to me is the secret, that you try to transform a thought into a formula. Yes? Like I say, when I said I take the smallest symmetry, just for us here,
mm-hmm.
Because I didn't want to have more nodes than necessary to make a modulation. You know, I don't want to have all the nodes because all the nodes means I can play anything. I just want to have those nodes which are the minimum which I need to express in a unique way a certain structure. So this, I think this is logical, but then you have to play around with concepts. You have to find what is the concept which defines such a structure. Can I define an object which has this property and other properties? And you have to play around, you know. And I think then what you need is a big experience artistic experience in creating concepts.
Mm-hmm.
I think already when I made my doctoral thesis on the Finsler numbers, I invented a lot of small concepts and things, and at the end I proved the Fermat conjecture for all natural numbers, which are not classical natural numbers, but general numbers. And I invented the exponentiation and all different operations. And I remember my professor Herbert Gross, he said that I was a master in definition of objects, of concepts. So perhaps he was right, but
he's right.
That was always my central concern. And I think with the algebraic geometry of Grothendieck, which I had learned then anyway, you know what that means, is sheaf theory and an infinity of concepts, mm-hmm. architectures of concepts, and the whole commutative algebra, which is big concept. That's why I like Bourbaki. It's, for me, it's a big architectural construction. Mm-hmm. So I was really kind of very routine in thinking about, you know, concepts which had been invented by very clever modern mathematicians, like mm-hmm. Grothendieck's idea to step over to schemes from algebraic varieties, mm-hmm. to invent these general points, all these incredibly, to my mind, incredibly refined thinking in conceptual creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Conceptual creativity. This is the artistic point, you know.
Yes, and I see is that it's not only that you have this incredible architecture of mathematics, but the talent and the artistic part to select by experimenting lots of time, meditating,
yes.
about the concept, to create these concepts and to apply them in a very intelligent way. I think that's very difficult, and that's one of your big talents, no? And contributions,
yes.
I should say, no?
Might be that perhaps I stress too much this part, you know. I'm not a really good mathematician in the sense of, you know, Fields Medal or something. I have proved some theorems, that's okay, but from the point of view of real hard mathematics, I'm on the lower level, you know. You know, I mean, really difficult, hard, like, you know, Fermat or Weyl conjectures, I'm very low. But I think I've never been interested in solving problems just to open a coconut.
Mm-hmm.
But just by the hammer and sizzle.
Yes.
And you know, Grothendieck said there are two methods to open a coconut.
Brute force,
to kill it, but then you know, or else you will put it into the warm water in the sea, and then you turn it from time to time, and after a fortnight you come again, and you can, and every child can open it, because it's just broken, it's soft, you know. And he said, it's clear what is my point of view. His point of view was, of course, mm-hmm. not the brute force.
Of course.
And now the point is here, why, what is the interesting thing in mathematics? And of course, you would say, okay, you didn't really cut a big coconut in your life, and you're right. I mean, I cut some small ones, but not really, you know, the big ones. And I think Rothendieck was also not interested in opening, in brutally opening or solving problems. He was more interested in you know, this architectural softening things until they become trivial. And I remember I was very long conservative. I was in fact starting algebraic geometry because I was interested in the Fermat mm-hmm. conjecture, which I had solved for those non-standard numbers. And all of a sudden, you know, I came to that problem that the Fermat conjecture, when you replace exponentiation by multiplication, if you replace addition by the sequencer, which is kind of the hierarchically lower thing, it becomes trivial because it's a times b plus 1 equal b times no a times n plus 1 equals b times n, which has no solution, of course, you know. So I thought, well, can't I transport this fact to by this, you know, in recursive definitions of the higher operations, kind of conserve this fact by this transport, by defining higher operations by recursion. And I started going into a whole, I cannot tell you, in a whole function theoretical consideration of invariance of those topological deformations. And so I was much more interested in what happens with the concepts when I move them in a definition of a new concept from an old one. Mm-hmm. And kind of recursion is a typical transition, you know, it goes very slow, of course, mm-hmm. it goes from 0 to 1 and so on. So I was more interested in what happens to the concepts. And still, I have thought about that a few days ago. I think mathematicians are too strongly interested in sports, in the, mm-hmm. being the best and the first mm-hmm. to kill that coconut, you know. And I, of course, it's beautiful to kill it, but I think you also kill an understanding, in the sense of then you're no longer interested in kind of perhaps deeper structures, which, because with the Hebrew you kill also the meat inside, you know. So I'm still interested in those more subtle questions of what happens with concepts when I deform them and when I make new ones. And I think the theory of definitions, to me this would be kind of a future mathematics. Mm-hmm. The theory of definitions, meaning what happens when we define things? What is the information flow? What do we lose? What do we gain? What happens with the information when we generate an inductive construction? Yes, and nobody's interested. It's okay, you can define it in a new unique way, and you know, I'm not happy with that.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting, of course.
I don't know what you think.
Nobody.
This is another way of thinking about mathematics.
The first time I hear it myself.
Oh, really?
Yes, that I never heard this stuff before.
Yeah, you can be critical. I mean, I don't want you to believe me, you know.
Oh, wow. But let me change a little bit away from this. We were talking yesterday, and I told you what Claudio Rao thought about performance or interpretation, if we say in Spanish, not execution, which is a very very strong word, no? Like the joke, as so what two people listening to somebody and says in Spanish, how you like his execution? He said, I agree. Shoot him, no?
So the, yeah. Well, okay, yes, 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 performance.
I know that there is a formal difference between, but Rao says that once the artist pays attention to the score as a basis, he puts his own personality to create this music.
No? Yes.
And then this would give path to this this thing we were talking yesterday, this diagram you showed me was very yes. interesting. Could you tell us a little bit about it, how it was works?
You know, I think we first have to come back to Gorau and appreciate that a performance is not just, you know, as I said yesterday.
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to say.
It's not just a waiter who brings a dish from the kitchen to the client.
Yes.
You know, in the sense that you bring Beethoven to the audience and you're just a servant and you are doing nothing else than transport something from A to B. Mm-hmm. This is completely, but this is a very classical misunderstanding. And in fact, if you play a piece like it is written, it sounds horrible. You can make the experiments. I think humans cannot do this, but computers can play. And I have made this experiment with Schumann pieces, you know, really beautiful pieces. And they sound horrible. And this is absolutely, you know, the proof that, one of the simple proofs that a performer is making much more than transporting something given from A to B. And I mean, the science of performance is an extremely complicated science. It starts from understanding, for example, the time shaping, the tempo, the agogics, which is an extremely delicate science. For example, if you just think about, you have an important chord which you want to play, or a small spot of a melodic passage, and you think, okay, I should go down with the tempo there, you know, I want to stress, halt a little bit, and then to tell people that now this is an important thing. And we have made experiments with a software to go down and then go up with the tempo. And at first we thought, okay, let's go down, say, one quarter note before, and then I go down with the tempo, and then stay down, and then wait another quarter note and go up. And then we listen it, and it sounds horrible because it's so stupid, overdressed in the sense of, if it's like when you cook, you know, and you want to salt something, and you put a kilogram of salt in, that's everybody would say, okay, now we know you wanted to salt it, but not so much. So we learned that this going down with the tempo is something very short. You just go down, you give just a tip of a spoon of this spice, you know? Uh-huh. So it's like cooking. It's something very subtle. So the whole performance theory is, of course, much more complicated than tempo. You have articulation, you have the whole dynamics, you have many, many things. Mm-hmm. So what I want to say that even if you look just scientifically at what happens in you know, shaping the score, it's extremely different from a mechanical reproduction, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is just, you know, scientifically measuring quantitatively what happens. Now, the other point is that, of course, it's not just a question of a little bit slower, and it just, you know, they call that humanizer in some software. Make just some random variations of the tempo, and then this is the performer, you know. They call that humanizer, you know, uh-huh. It must be human, yeah. That's a function that you have in logic, for example. It's absolutely stupid. It's an offense of a performer. Yes. Saying just, you know, you cannot do it as precisely as possible, so you just, the machine makes for you this going up a little bit and down. So, of course, this is the opposite, is that the performer is very creative, mm-hmm. is adding much of the meaning, is also creating much of the meaning which is not given in the score. Mm-hmm. And I always call the score, you know, deep frozen gestures.
Yes.
Which have to be thought, which have to be kind of unfrozen. It's like a deep frozen pizza, you cannot eat it.
Yes.
You have to, you know, to cook it, to make it hot, to put it into a kind of a state where the humans can understand, appreciate it. And this is full of...
Or do it from scratch, you know? Do it the bread, put the cheese, put the things there.
Yes.
Yeah, no.
But even if you have a deep frozen pizza, like, you know, like a score with a completely mm-hmm. written thing, you have to add many things to make it into something interesting, you know. You know that even deep frozen things, if you unfreeze them in the restaurants, they do that, they still have to add some fresh stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's really complicated to turn something kind of frozen, encoded things into something living. And it's really kind of an expression of an understanding of music. You have to understand very much on whatever level you see that. It can be emotional or gestural or analytical, but you have to add very much to turn this dead things into something living. And this is essential. You know, Paul Valéry, the famous French poet, he said that exécuter, no, this is for us French, okay. Exécuter le poème, le poème c'est l'exécution du poème. Yes. So the poème is its performance. Mm-hmm. It's the poème does not exist outside the performance.
Right.
You know? Just they said it's not a poème if it's not performed.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think Schoenberg was really completely wrong when he said the performer is just a waiter. That's what he said, you know, it just has to be quiet and just, you know, make things which are written in the score. It's not true. The music which is from the score is just shit. It doesn't sound anything. You have to really make it into something say communicative, human, embodied. And now there comes in, of course, the personality of Arau, which means what is personality? What is human? What is the human existence? What is the dimension which we accept as a kind of a message, as a kind of, you know, substantial thing? And I think the humans live in the body and in the gestures. They dance. They live in a gestural kind of expressivity. And you know that even in the other direction, the score itself stems from gestures, because the notes first were the neumes. The neumes were gestures, very, very short hints, but of gestural nature. So the score was also created as a kind of an abstraction from gestures. So what I want to say is, this Arau statement is not only clear that you have to add a lot of meaning and of understanding and of expression, but it's also turning it into something human, something which is our dimension. Mm-hmm. And this is gestural utterance. This is kind of the presence, the dancing presence, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if you wanted me to tell you a little bit about that scheme, which I mean, the diagram, then I discovered, you know, at the School of Music that, of course, we have a lot of professors who are, we call them applied. Professor, they make, they educate pianists and cellists and whatever the musicians are. But there is no methodology to tell them what happens when they perform. You know, it's a big, they are only told, there is a Beethoven up there and there is this audience, you transform, please, the holy Beethoven to the holy, because they pay for holy audience, you know. So, and then the students got, of course, a nervous crisis, you know, because before they perform, they are kind of completely tensed. Because why? They are afraid that they don't serve as they should, you know. It's a servant who has to serve 5 plates, and he is afraid, because he's a beginner, to throw down one of them. So they are afraid of making errors. So it boils down, am I playing correctly or not? And the audience also listen to, is he bringing the play correctly or not?
Yes.
So everything boils down to a mechanical error detector, you know, an error detector. Uh-huh. Instead of listening to music, they listen to error.
Yes.
They must say, beep, 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 error, beep, error, beep, error. I mean, this is not what it is about. So I discovered that they have no culture of giving the performer their ontology, the way of being a performer, which means many things. It means I have my body, I have the instrument, and I make sounds. And this is not just a way of making sounds. Now, this comes down to what is a musician, you know, in the no theater, in the classical Japanese no theater, you have the stage. The stage is a big instrument, you know, because you have the drums, you have big drums below the stage. So when the shitte, the main person wants to express something, he hits the stage and he is a drummer, mm-hmm. because the drum makes boom, you know. Yes. So what does this teach us? It teaches us that a stage can be an instrument. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that conversely, an instrument is also a stage. Yes, in the sense that when you play the instrument, mm-hmm. you are also an actor which dances on the instrument. And this is also an aspect which is completely neglected. You know, I think we have heard it today. Mm-hmm. You know, when Robert was playing the flute, he yes. said in the conservatory, we are taught to not to move, to mm-hmm. play it like, you know, a dead silhouette, like doot, doot, because we have to make just the sound, which is, you know, this abstract thing. It's about this spiritual thing which is kind of coming from God and going to God, and we are just the sinful flesh. And yes, the waiter, you know, who stinks, and he should be better absent, you know. I was also, in a certain time, I thought, oh, these actors, they stink and they sweat, and what is that? But I think that's the point, that you are an actor, and that's extremely important. It's not only important because it's a show, because I want to see, like, Lang Lang, somebody moving like an idiot, you know? Mm-hmm. Because it's not that, it's that the gestures define the coherence of my music. Mm-hmm. You know, I have always discussed that with those who say, when you play the piano, why are you moving like strange dancing things? Isn't it just sufficient to go down the key with a certain velocity, and then you have the pitch and you cannot do anything else? So why are you moving the hands in that strange way? And I said, yes, you're right, that you have to go down in that velocity, and for the key, it doesn't matter how you dance. But the music is not just a kind of a disjoint union of separate keys. It's a coherent shape. So how can I guarantee that I play all these things in a connected, nice way, so that every key is pressed down in the right way? And that can only happen if I connect them by a dancing movement of my hand. So mm-hmm. the connection, which is not visible, that my dance is not visible, and it doesn't matter for the single notes, but for the, you know, the connection, the loudness goes up and down, the tempo, all these parameters, to shape them, I need this higher kind of higher language of gestures, which creates the coherence of my playing. Mm-hmm. So the gesture is not just nice theater playing, it's kind of the spirit which connects the notes, you know. Mm-hmm. So this, they are not taught this. No. They are kind of taught to stay still like this and just transform Beethoven into the ear of the hearer, of the audience, which is of course stupid, because you play bad if you just transport something. You mm-hmm. have to move, you have to shape the music as a dancer on the stage of the instrument. Mm-hmm. This is one important thing which I called, you know, the body, the axis of the body. Yes, mm-hmm. my body, the sounding body, the sound, the body of the sound, mm-hmm. and the instrument, which is the stage, which is the interface. And then, of course, there is the other dimension. There are three dimensions. The second is, for me, the dimension of the how do I do this? What I do, I have said now, I have the bodies. But how do I do is, to my mind, the question of the gesture. The gesture tells me about the shaping of the beauty, you know? I can, of course, as I said, I can move up and down with my body, but how I move up and down, you know, is another dimension. Mm-hmm. And I think this dimension of the gesture is a very important additional one to the bodies, which tells me how I kind of define the space and time where the sounds will be placed. So it's about defining where I am. And, you know, it is not true that a good performer should just come into a given space and say, hello, here I am, like I move through as given, like in the restaurant, you know, I move through the given restaurant, mm-hmm. like the waiter. No, the artist creates the space, he creates the time. And you know, the fascination of a good performer is that you see this person makes something. He creates the time, you know. Marcel Baxo, this famous mime, he has a fantastic poem which I have in my free jazz book, you know. He tells you that the artist, the mime, he makes the time by his movements, he defines the space, he defines time. And you know, Einstein was asked, what is time? And he said, it's just the pointer which moves around, it's a gesture, that's time. So in that sense, the artist, by his movement, creates a space, creates time, he creates where we are, you know, where we move. And so it's a very important action. It's not just, you know, abstract, but it's ontological, the making of the space. So if a performer is a maker, then he can or she can fascinate you. And if it just he comes in like a waiter and walks through a given space, it's really not that interesting seeing somebody moving through a given space. So that's the second thing. And I think very important is that you also enable others to come into that space. For example, this is important for improvisation, but also in an orchestral or the chamber music work, I don't know, piano trio or take a string quartet, you have to give the other musicians the space to make their gestures and receive their gestures in your space. So that means you listen. Listening, to me, this very famous musical listening, means open a big space for the other to move into something and receive the other, say, come here, you know, I'm open. And then you go back and, of course, expect that the other also open his space or her space. But I think this gesture is a creation of a space, but not only, you know, an individual for one person, but also for the social interaction of the musicians. Also, of course, with the audience. For example, you were telling me Beethoven had, what was the sonata of Waldstein or someone you told me, or what is the Appassionata, where you had this pause.
The pathetic sonata.
Pathetic, thank you. Well, you know, he creates a space, but if you don't understand that this space is to be, you know, filled up with understanding and with kind of resonance, it's not just annoying, we don't know what to do and wait until the next thing happens. But we have to fill that space with understanding. So this kind of listening, and in the sense of opening and making a gesture, in the sense of going back, you know, doing all these very important things, this is also in free jazz extremely important. So this is the second dimension, I say in a few words. And of course, if you put together the gesture and the body, this two-dimensional space now is what I call dancing. Dancing is the gesture which is embodied. And then there is a third axis, and I'm finishing here, and I think this is an extremely important one, which I call the structural, which could be the answer to the question why or what for am I doing things. So this is kind of, you know, you have structure which you get from the past or from a score, and then you shape new structures in the future. So it's kind of a flow from past structures to the future structure. This is extremely complicated, but I think this kind of management of structures is also very important. And important for if you have a score, but also important if you improvise, because you take what you have heard and you use it to shape the future. And these three axes, to my mind, you know, is what I called the balanced dancing presence. And I think this kind of space-time and action space and kind of ontological substance is very important to be a good performer. A performer should really live in this kind of imaginary space-time to make the music real, and also, you know, create the beauty and be somebody who fascinates, somebody who listens. Because I don't want to see somebody transporting Beethoven from A to B. I don't know whether that's...
No, that's marvelous. I mean, such enlightenment in these concepts you just told me now. We were discussing this at the seminar we just yes. had, and I think the seminar we had in Huatulco this today, yesterday, and the day before yesterday was a very, very successful way of joining many persons in music and mathematics both together to listen, to learn all this way of thinking. And I'm very grateful that you could come to Mexico, join us for all this beautiful things you just told me.
I also have at this point, of course, to thank you, because I think you have made always the first step in a new direction of this putting art and science together. This is, I think, nobody does that really. No, I mean everybody does it, but not, you know, as the first. They come as the second or third, but that's really unique. I thank you so much, and I think today. Not today only, but this seminar was, to my mind, also the first time where we really thought about the deep connections between mathematics and music. Not just, you know, you can apply it and there are examples and there are theorems or whatever. I think really deep questions of also why certain persons think that they cannot be or should not be united. Mm-hmm. We have thought very deeply, and this is very important. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Guarino, and I hope to see you soon again in Mexico. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.